All right. Well, thank you all for being here. My name is Andy Jennings. I'll introduce myself a little bit more in just a second. But I'd like to go ahead and start off with a prayer. We need to bathe everything in that tonight. So if y'all would bow with me real quick. Father, thank you so much for this evening and for everything that everyone is learning, for Jeff's words earlier in the main session. And I pray that you'll be with us as we go through this next hour. So we talk about what it means to teach in a small group setting, how to be effective and how to help facilitate life change through that. Father, help us to put away any pride that we have in our abilities and to trust you to guide us and to lead us in the way that we do this. It's in your son's name that I pray. Amen. All right, so that is this session, Teach, Don't Preach. We're talking specifically about teaching within a small group setting, which would be most of your life Bible studies or if you do a weekday grow group or something like that. And the theme is going to be developing teaching skills that empower and change lives. There is a distinct difference between what Greg does on a Sunday morning and what you do on a Sunday morning. And if you try to do what Greg does, you're going to run into problems. And if he were to try to do what you're supposed to be doing, he wouldn't be as effective because he's in front of a bunch of people and he can't do what you have the opportunity to do. But we're going to look at what is it that you have an opportunity to do, how to take advantage of that, how to cultivate skills that really help what you're teaching stick in people's minds and help them grow. So that's what we're after today. As we begin, we want to look at teaching rather than, in particular, teaching rather than lecturing. It's hard to preach in a life Bible study. I mean, if you've been a pastor of a small church, then you know it, you can preach to a group of 20 or 30 or even 50, but it can be a little bit more difficult. You really just feel like you're teaching a small group Bible study. The trouble that most teachers run into is that they lecture, right? It is a very one-sided thing that they're doing. I have the information. You need the information. Let me impart the information to you, and you should just respond with your undying gratitude for what I am providing for you. If you do it that way, and this goes across the board, this is across age groups, across marital status, if you do it that way, you may be helping them with knowledge, but you will be depriving them of what life Bible study groups are really all about. That is the change that is occurring in their life as a result of what you are trying to tell them about. So if you have your Bibles, I want to talk about the risk we all run. So I want you to open up to James chapter 3. If you don't have your Bible, shame on you. Who comes to church without their Bible? But you can be one of those pagans that uses a phone app if you have to. Open up to James chapter 3. If somebody would, read James chapter 3, verse 1. And raise your hand so I know who's reading. I see one person with a Bible. Are you the only one? Oh, I saw him first. Sorry. All right. How many of you have heard that verse before? Every teacher needs to hear that verse. Your name was Jeremy, is that right? You are the proud owner of a $10 gift card that is good at multiple locations. If you would just fill out the card there and give it back to Joey, who's one of our facilitators. That way we know who got it. See, that's what you get when you participate. It's valuable. So James warns at the beginning of this section, "Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we will incur a stricter judgment." What does he mean? What does he mean you're going to incur a stricter judgment? Right, so you are standing up in front of a group pretending, at least, right? Maybe you actually do, but you're at least saying, I have the authority to be able to impart spiritual truth, biblical truth to you. That's the particular risk that we all run. Right? That's why when we hear pastors who get up, you get somebody like Creflo Dollar who says, God has called me to have a $67 million jet so that I can fly and do the work of God. How do we know that that's probably not accurate to what God has called him to do? Well, biblical truth tells us that more than likely that is inaccurate. Now, only God knows his heart, but in general, asking for $67 million to buy a private jet so you can fly around doesn't fit into the biblical model of what a shepherd should look like. But our job, if you feel like you have that call on your life, or if you just decide, I want to step up into that position, you need to know this is the risk you're running, that you will incur a stricter judgment from God because you have taken on a role of instruction. Now, we know from Jesus' own ministry that he wasn't very nice to the Jewish teachers, was he? Who were the Jewish teachers of his day? The scribes and Pharisees and the Sadducees. What are the? This is my favorite Bible joke. What's the difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Does anybody know? They didn't believe in a resurrection, right? And that's why they were sad, you see. Ha! Come on. Pity laugh there. Come on. That's how you tell the difference. They were sad, you see, because they didn't believe in a resurrection. Jesus wasn't very nice to the teachers of his day. And in particular, if you go back and you read John chapter 3, where he's talking to Nicodemus, and he's talking to him about what it means to be born again. What is he? There's a phrase he uses in there that always struck me. He said, "Are you the teacher of Israel, and yet you don't know these things?" Now, if Jesus looks you in the face and says, "You've taken on this position of authority, and you don't know this," that just it sends a chill up my spine as a teacher. Because I have to picture Jesus telling me that too, right? You stand up every week and you teach people, and yet you don't know these things. It is incumbent upon you as a teacher to know what in the world you're talking about, which means that you have to spend more time in study than the average person. You have to spend more time reading more parts of Scripture. Right? There are these wonderful parts of our Bibles where the pages are just brown because our fingers have been there so much. And there are places where you can crack it open and still smell a new book smell. Because you've never separated those two pages before, particularly books like Amos and Obadiah, you know, these places that we don't visit. And yet, as teachers, it is incumbent upon us to know what the Scriptures say in order to be able to teach it. Now, don't let that frighten you so much that you say, until I feel like I'm an expert, I shouldn't teach. You will grow in your knowledge as you teach, but know what you're taking on. And I want to go on and read the rest of this paragraph. Most of your Bibles will have this as a single paragraph. Starting in verse 2, it says, "For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Now if we put the bits into horses' mouths so that they will obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Look at the ships also. Though they are so great, they are driven by strong winds. They are still directed by a very small rudder, wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things." So there the paragraph ends. And what he goes on to say in the next paragraph is important too, and in continuing this thought. But what you may have never done, if you've heard James 3:1, is connected it to what comes next about bridling the tongue. It is all one thought in James's mind. It's one paragraph. He starts by saying, not many should become teachers. What is the teacher's primary tool? It is our words. And so he launches into this whole thing saying, think about the fires you can start. Think about the problems you can cause. Think about the errors you can make in what you say. Because that is the primary means by which you teach people. So what he means by stricter judgment is not just that you've stepped into a role. It's specifically about what you say as a teacher. What is it that you are conveying to people that biblical truth is? And James knows as much as anyone that teachers have a position of respect that can easily be led astray. He was a good Jew. He didn't believe that his brother was the Messiah until after Jesus revealed himself to him after his resurrection. Right? You've got James as a skeptic. But he knows where this stuff can go wrong. He's seen it all his life. And in particular, he saw it with the Judaizers. Right? There's a story in Acts chapter 15. If you've never read this, I encourage you, go back and read it. James is the leader of the Jerusalem church at this point. He's the head of the church at Jerusalem. Paul and Barnabas have just finished their first missionary journey, and they're going out and they're preaching salvation by grace through faith. And there's this group of Jews that have been following along behind them saying, no, 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 salvation by grace through faith and following the law. Particularly males, you need to be circumcised, and everybody needs to come under the Jewish law. Salvation is by faith and works. And it bothers Paul and Barnabas so much that this group is coming behind them and spreading this message that they actually go back to Jerusalem and they talk to Peter and to James and they say, have we been sharing the wrong gospel? What is it that you are teaching people is the gospel that Christ shared. And it's at this point that James, he's the one who speaks in Acts chapter 15. He says, no, you've got it right. The gospel is salvation by grace through faith alone. And it seems good to us that we encourage the Gentile churches not to be bothered with these groups that are coming in behind, and only to not eat meat with blood in it and to abstain from fornication. That's James's role. He saw this firsthand. He knows what can happen when you have teachers teaching the wrong things. It brought Paul and Barnabas back from the mission field. It was such a big deal. And this was James's position to deal with. So what I want you to do, you should have a book, and you should have a notes section in that book. I want you to take 30 seconds. All right, I'm going to time you. And I want you to write down three ways that you have seen teachers struggle or fail with their words. It can be a sentence, it can be one word. But I want you to write down three different ways. Ready? Go. You have 30 seconds. Ten more seconds. Stop. How many of you came up with three? Not many. How many of you came up with two? How many of you came up with one? Most of us in 30 seconds can think of at least one way that we have either personally experienced or seen a teacher fail with their words. Right? They've either struggled or they failed with their words. It can be somebody who took on the position of teacher but didn't have the skill set. And so they didn't really know what to do with it, and they just copied Rick Warren's sermons or something like that and just kept going with that. We've seen people get up, and we've probably all heard somebody say something, and you go, I don't think that that's right. That doesn't... One that I heard, someone was teaching through Philippians chapter 4, and Paul talks about how you are supposed to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. And this guy said, now working out, I mean, what do we think of when we think of working out? We think of lifting weights, we think of pumping iron, and that's what Paul is talking about in Philippians. I mean, you've got to really work at your faith. You've got to build those spiritual muscles. There's a problem with that. That idea of working out only has existed, like using the phrase working out, has only existed for about the past 50 years. Paul did not mean that by his words. But I've also heard people say, and I've seen it even quoted in, there's a movie, some exorcism movie, that actually quotes this at the end. The idea that this means that we all work out our salvation in different ways, that we all find our own path to God, and our goal is to work out our salvation. As long as we do it with fear and trembling, then he honors that. That's called heresy, right? And I've heard that taught by teachers in Sunday school classes, and I've seen it at the ends of movies and things like that. Those are problems, and we've encountered people who have gone wayward, whether it was intentionally or unintentionally, with their words. I would encourage you, if you couldn't think of it in 30 seconds, go back and revisit this exercise and try to think of it. Let it act as a warning for you of what can happen when you don't do your due diligence. Now, I want you to take 2 minutes, and I want you to write down, what is one change you can make this week to control your words better so you can be a more effective teacher? If you're not currently teaching, I want you to think about how you converse with people, right? The way that you just talk in general. What is a change you can make this week to control your words better? And don't you dare tell me there's nothing you can do. Right, James goes on in the rest of this verse to say, you are a perfect man if you can control your words, or a perfect woman. I'm not perfect, you're not perfect. All of us can improve. So I want you to take 2 minutes, and I want you to write down what is the way that you can do it better, and I want you to write down what is the risk that you run if you don't make that change starting today. So I'll give you 2 minutes to do that. I want you to really think about it. One more minute. Okay, everybody should be done. You're probably done a little bit ago because it probably didn't take you too long to think of something that you could work on. Now, I'm going to make it really uncomfortable for you. I want you to pair up with somebody, guys with guys and girls with girls. I want you to tell them what you're going to work on, and I want you to pray for each other about that. I want you to spend 2 or 3 minutes doing that. When everybody kind of quiets down and turns back to their tables, we'll start again. Let's be accountable to each other, right? Let's be accountable to each other. You are all Houston's first people. Let's be accountable to each other as a church. So take 2 or 3 minutes, pair off, and admit to somebody what you're working on. No exceptions. I'll come hunt you down. Here, join their group. If you're not praying for each other yet, go ahead and move toward that phase of the exercise. About 30 more seconds and then we're going to move on. All right, let me close this out. Father, thank you for this group who has come together, and I thank you for the introspection that you've given us through this passage. I pray that as we collectively try to teach better, Lord, that we would rely on you for that strength, we would rely on you for that wisdom. Lord, I know that my own frustrations can even come through in my teaching, and I can sometimes let my words slip away and reveal things that I shouldn't, and I pray that as I'm working on that and as these teachers and even teachers in training are thinking about those areas that they could shore up in order to be more effective for you, Father, help us to lean on you for that. Give us wisdom. Help us to have the courage and the strength to overcome the temptations that arise in our lives. It's in your Son's name that I pray. Amen. All right, y'all can kind of get back to your seats or remain where you are, whatever floats your boat. One final exercise that I would encourage you to do after this, if you are smartphone savvy, is to go into your notifications and type that in as a recurring reminder in your phone to pray about that daily, right? Just set a certain time every day, have it come up as a reminder in your phone, and just stop for 30 seconds even and pray about that. It will greatly improve your prayer life on the one hand, but then it's hard not to actually improve a skill that you're praying about improving. So it will lead you along the way. That's something you can do as we go along or later on tonight. Now, here's what I hope I've done. I hope that what I've done is have you do just about everything I'm about to teach you how to do in order to have an effective lesson. All right, how do you feel like you have a greater grasp on James chapter 3 verses 1 through 5? Do you feel like you understand that passage a little bit better? Do you have something that you take away that impacts your spiritual life from that? And something that we as a group now are working together on. So you have an individual spiritual goal. We have group spiritual goals. We have reached into each other's lives through prayer. These are all aspects of what are very successful teachers. Now, I don't consider myself super successful yet. I've been doing this for about a decade. I hope to do it for another 4 or 5 decades, and by then, maybe I'll be something to mimic. But today, I hope that I just kind of gave you an impression of what I'm talking about so that you have something to reflect back on as we go. And here's the thing. It's all about hooks. Here's what I mean by that. There's a great book out called Made to Stick. And I mentioned this in my last lesson too for a different reason, but what they talk about when they say, what are ideas that as you're teaching them, it sticks? And they did it from a marketing standpoint in particular. How do you get a marketing idea to stick so that people buy your product or remember your idea or whatever? But the conclusion they came to, and I think it's correct, is that it's all about the number of hooks you can get into the idea so that more emotional connections, more thought connections, more intellectual connections are made with what you're trying to convey. That's what I tried to do with you today. We had an intellectual discussion. What does it mean that we'll incur a stricter judgment? We had self-reflection. What are those areas where you might incur a stricter judgment if you don't shore them up? As you write it out, as you pray for each other about it, all of those things are creating multiple ways that you can now reflect back on that idea or that will bring that idea to mind. So first, we want to engage the audience. When we talk about teaching, not preaching, engaging the audience is one of the first things that differentiates the two. When Greg gets up and he preaches, he's not asking people to respond individually. I started the lesson by having somebody else read a passage and then giving them a gift card for doing it. Right? That always helps. But I engage the audience. I make the audience part of the learning experience. That's a primary difference between not only preaching, but in particular in your life Bible studies, it's the difference between lecturing and teaching. Lecturing is a very one-sided thing. I stand up here, I have information, I convey that information, you take notes. I don't care what you have to say, I don't care what you think, I don't care if you get application, that's your job. My job is to tell you. That's lecturing. That's what you did in school, it's very effective in school. Well, that's arguable. I liked it in school. But it doesn't work in your life Bible study because your primary goal as a teacher in life Bible study is not to convey information. Did y'all know that? Your primary goal is to facilitate changing lives, to facilitate spiritual growth. Now, that will include conveying information, but they're not the same thing. Conveying information is only a part of your job in teaching a life Bible study. So you want to engage the audience. But you can make people read, facilitate critical thinking. This is the self-analysis, right? This is thinking through the arguments. What are some biblical examples of people who failed with their words? What are some examples that you know of people who have failed with their words? What is the risk you run if you fail with your words? Think about those things. Work through it for yourself. Don't just let me tell you. I can give you plenty of examples of people who have failed with their words, and I'm sure that would be helpful, but it is less meaningful to you unless you think about your own situation and experiences that you've had. You're getting those hooks in the water, right? You're putting hooks into the idea. Oh yeah, I remember this guy. Man, I remember how it felt when he said that. I remember how weird it was, how that seemed wrong, and I remember somebody asking me a question about that later, right? These are these mental hooks that you're putting into an idea. Facilitate critical thinking. Make people figure out how the lesson applies. This is another major difference. When a preacher stands up and preaches, it is his job to come up with application to convey to the audience. Now, hopefully the audience is sitting there thinking about personal application, but he doesn't have a chance to ask them about application. And it's very hard in the middle of a service to do what we did, where I say, hey, take 2 or 3 minutes and write this down, and then to stand there as a pastor and count 2 or 3 minutes out. When was the last time somebody did that? It doesn't work well in a large group. And it's also a difference with lecturing, right? Lecturers never stop. They never take a breath. They always go overtime, and then everybody's annoyed. And then you start packing up your backpack when it's 5 minutes to go, and they say, stop that. You're interrupting my lecture. That's not what we're about. You want to encourage people, think about this in your own life. Right. What are you learning today? How does that attach to 2 or 3 things in your life so that when those things arise, your mind will immediately come back to this biblical principle that we learned about today and how to deal with those applications in your life? Make it personal. Make it personal every time. And then make application a group effort, right? It's your individual, but you know what? Don't keep it to yourself. Study after study shows that when you pair up or when you partner up, you are much more likely to succeed, right? Everybody knows. How many of y'all are resolvers, right? You make New Year's resolutions. How many of y'all don't admit that you make New Year's resolutions because you don't want people to know you failed at them? Statistically speaking, 50% of people will fail within 6 weeks of the beginning of the new year when they make resolutions. that number decreases dramatically if you tell somebody your resolution and ask them to help you keep it. Because now you're responsible to them for something that you've told them, and they're responsible to you to help you. So when we make application a group effort, when you tell people not just, hey, think about how this applies to you, but think about it, write it down, and then tell somebody about it. That now it's out in the open, right? And sometimes people can abuse this. There are people in your life Bible studies who will just start pouring out their whole life story. Man, I'm struggling with this, I'm struggling with that. Drug addiction, pornography, it's all there. Well, you have to have a really strong person who can be an accountability partner for that. But in general, people are going to be pretty normal about this. But it helps. It creates those hooks in the idea when other people know, you know what? This is what's going on in my life. They can pray for you. They can ask you about it. And you know at any point you could be held accountable for what you said you're going to do. That is a much more encouraging thing to actually work on it, right? It's a motivator. So it's all about those hooks. You want to put as many hooks into the idea that you're teaching as possible so that people don't forget it the moment they walk out the door. Which, by the way, is what most people do. You do it. How many of you remember what Greg preached on last week? What is he preaching on right now? Purity. Is he going straight through a book of the Bible or is he kind of moving around on the topic? He's going through Isaiah? Okay. What was an illustration he used last week? Okay, right, and why do you remember that? Probably because he said hell no in it. Yeah, right? So we all know this. I mean, this happens all the time. I love it when people, this is my experience with preaching. This is my favorite thing. Most of my preaching experience has been at churches that have an older congregation, and there is always that sweet little lady who sits right in the front pew who looks like this. 5 minutes into my preaching. You know who the first person to come up and tell me what a great job I did after my sermon is? That sweet little old lady. She was unconscious for the whole thing. But man, she was up there. I wish you were our pastor. You're so good at this. And you can go, well, what did I talk about? Oh, I don't know, but it was just so good. Right? Right? This, if you teach long enough, man, high school teachers know this better than anybody. But if you teach long enough, you're going to realize people will forget most of what you say. Unless they have a reason to remember it. And the best way to give them a reason to remember it is to have them write something down that they're accountable for. Just taking notes. My bookshelf is filled with sermon notes. You know how often I go back and read those things? But if I have to talk with somebody tomorrow about what I did to keep something that I said I was going to do, then I'm going to remember that. So you see how this works. You get all of this going. People are engaged. They're not falling asleep on you because they may be called on to read. You might keep a tennis ball right up here, and if somebody falls asleep, peg them in the head and then put a billiard ball up there next week. Nobody's falling asleep on you then. All right, use these tactics. It's all about the hooks there. And then your job before you teach, right? There is a lot that should go into the process before you ever get up and you ever teach. And this is across the board. Don't ever get up and teach unless you are prepared. You better know the passage you're teaching or the verses that you're bringing in. Don't you do a Saturday night special. Don't let me catch you doing a Saturday night special where at 10 o'clock you go, oh man, what's the passage? I got to write down a couple of things. Okay, I'm ready to go. Because somebody will visit your class that Sunday and they'll say, you know what, I've really been struggling with what this passage talked about. Now, what should I do about this? What should I do about that? And you're going to go, I don't know. I looked at this for 30 minutes last night and then I went to bed. Be prepared. Spend time during the week. Spend time during the week reading. Read the passage 2 or 3 times before you ever start to write your lesson. Think about personal application, your own application, before you start asking other people to make application. Ask yourself, is there something in this lesson that I need to work on and I need to pray about before I ever get up and I tell other people they need to work on and pray about this? Right? Because the greatest way that people will ignore what you have to say is if you're a hypocrite and you get up and you tell them to do something that you're not doing and they know it. Be prepared when you get up. Now, play on words, be prepared. See what I did there? Pray. And then pray again and then pray some more. Because you are not smart enough to teach the Bible. Do you know that? You're not smart enough to teach the Bible. Paul said that. Spiritual things are spiritually discerned. The only reason that you can get up and teach Scripture with any power is because the Holy Spirit is in you, working through you. That is the only reason. You can be smart and be a high school teacher. You can be smart and be a college professor. Smarts will not make you a good Bible teacher. In fact, smart people are some of the most dangerous Bible teachers when they rely on their own smarts to do it. Make sure that everything is bathed in prayer. Ask God for His wisdom in what to say, His wisdom in how to answer people's questions, His wisdom on what the application ought to be, and then pray for the people who heard your lesson after it's over. You cannot pray enough when you're a teacher because you are not smart enough on your own. I don't care who you are. I don't care how many PhDs you have. If God isn't working through you, if God's power is not behind what you're saying, you will not cause life change. You will not facilitate life change. I think that's a better way of saying it. So pray over it. This is really tough. Solicit constructive criticism. How many of you like being told you did a bad job? How many of you like when you think you did a good job and somebody says, well, I was okay, but here's something you could work on? This is not easy, but it will make you better. It will make you better every time you teach. Now, don't do this with just anybody. You all know in your life Bible studies who are those mature Christians. They can be friends or they can be other leaders in your class. Who are those mature Christians that you can go to them and you can say, how did the lesson come across today? Did you understand it? Did my illustrations make sense? Did I do the teaching hokey pokey? I've probably been doing this, right? You don't realize it, but you're doing this while you're teaching. And you're swaying around. You know the best way to fix that? Record yourself and do it and watch it in fast forward. And you look like you're doing this while you're teaching, right? There's these ticks, the ums, the you knows, the rocking, the all that kind of stuff. Figure out ways that you can be better. Did I pick the right words? Did I say it in a way that was meaningful? Did I say it in a way that was understandable? Did I speak too fast, too slow? What are those things that I can get better at in order to be a better teacher? Get some people that you trust and get constructive criticism from them. And never, ever think that you're perfect. Never, ever think that there isn't something you can improve on. I know some really great teachers, and I listen to some really great teachers. I try to mimic a lot of what they do. But every time I listen to them, I think that could have been just a little bit better. I mean, just strictly from a critiquing standpoint, he could have said this a little bit better. This would have been a better word to use there. And you don't want to be really negative about it. What you're trying to do is say, man, they're really good. Most of what they do is terrific. And yet even I, as somebody who's listening to them, know that there's always something you could do that's a little bit better. And what that tells me is not, I'm better than this person because I saw that. No, what it tells me is even after 30 or 40 years of doing this, I can still improve. And so that will always be my job. I can never sit back on my laurels and think I'm good enough. Now, here's the temptation, because more than likely you won't do this on your own, but people will start coming up to you as you get better and tell you, man, that was great. You did a great job today. That illustration you used, that was awesome. Man, those questions you made us answer, those were tough. I really had to work through some stuff. And you start taking that in and you think, man, I must be pretty good. I must be pretty good at what I'm doing to have this many different people come up and tell me. Take compliments when people give them to you. Don't refuse them, but don't ever think that you've reached a point where you're good enough. Don't ever think that. You can always get better. You can always be working. So these are your jobs before you teach. And what I mean by that, in part, is you can get up and you can say, you know what, I'm going to do the best job I can today, but I'm also going to pay attention for those things that I do today that could be better next time. So be ready for that before you teach. That's your job before you ever get up there. All right, now here's something that is a little bit tricky. This is something very new. And we're going to talk about using media effectively as a teacher. Some of you, this will be less of a thing. Some of you, it'll be more. The younger you are, generally, the more effective this can be. But we have, I mean, in our church, we've got a guy named Ed Yates who's in our church. He's like a legend there. He's 80-something years old, and the guy uses more Facebook than the 20-year-olds in my class. So it doesn't matter how old you are, you can use these things. When I say using media, I'm not talking about using this TV here in your lesson. I'm talking about using the media platforms we have through our phones and through our computers to go beyond the classroom in your ability to teach. That's how I want you to view these things. They give you a tool that can allow you to teach when you're not even gathered together. We live in a digital world. And as much as some people like to go back to before we ever did that, it is here to stay. This computer, this newfangled computer thing, it's caught on, it's going to stay around. And we can use it or we can ignore it. And if we ignore it, we do it to our own detriment. Everyone has a smartphone, and this creates a particular set of challenges and a particular set of opportunities. The challenge is that while you're teaching, that Facebook button is just a thumb push away. And it can be very hard for some people to keep their attention going for 20 or 30 minutes while you're trying to work through a lesson without checking the Facebook feed. So that's a challenge, is to keep them from doing that. But the opportunity is, when you're outside of class, you can use that very Facebook feed to remind them about what you taught them. Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever thought about, right after Sunday school, maybe going on Twitter or going on your Facebook page and posting something about what you just taught and asking people in their comments, what was the application you got? And starting an online conversation that goes beyond the classroom? It can be done. It's not easy, but it can be done, and it can be very effective. Realize this, that young people have been trained to pay attention in 6 to 8 minute segments. This is what TV has taught us. If you watch a sitcom, you get 8 minutes of TV show and 4 minutes of commercials, and 8 minutes of TV show and 4 minutes of commercials, and then usually like that little 2 minute little funny thing at the end. That's how sitcoms work. We've been trained to think in these kinds of segments. You can use that in your lesson. Pause every 6 to 8 minutes and have people consider something or pray about something or talk to one another. The way that I do my lessons is I teach for about 10 minutes and then I ask, people are sitting around tables like this, I ask them to go to table discussion and to cover 2 questions that I've asked them, and I give them 10 minutes to answer those questions and then we talk about it as a class. I'm breaking up my lesson into manageable bites and then I'm allowing people to think about that. So I'd encourage you, don't spend just 30 minutes going on and on and on. I realize that's what I'm doing right now, but just ignore that for a second. Break up your lesson into 6 to 8 minute bites and then let people kind of ruminate on that by thinking about application or thinking about discussion, talking amongst themselves or praying for something. And then go back into your lesson. Now, this is fascinating. The average 20-year-old fits 18 hours of media into 16 hours of waking time. And how do they do that? Because they sit in front of the TV and have their phone on at the same time, and they're devouring 2 different types of media simultaneously. Because if you're going to work, then 8 of these hours are knocked off. People are fitting 15 to 18 hours of media into their evenings. That's crazy. They've got the TV going, they've got their phone going, and usually they have a computer on too. And they're doing things on all 3 simultaneously. They will be doing none of them well, but they are doing things on all 3 simultaneously. You can either let that go by, the fact that they are devouring that much media, or you can be part of it. It's up to you. How much do you want to engage in that particular way of reaching people? And realize that most millennials, this is people under the age of, or between the ages of 15 and 35, they rely on social media as their primary news source. They will get most of their news articles. They will get most of their social information. They will get most of what they think is important in their life. And they will get all of their cat videos off of Facebook. So do you want to be part of that or do you not? If this is where they are going to get their information, you have an opportunity to be part of that. Now let's talk a little bit about how you go about that. We want to redeem media. You don't just want to be part of the fuzz. Don't post a cat video and then Jesus juke them at the end of it, right? Do y'all know what a Jesus juke is? It's when there's a funny joke going around and somebody goes, well, Jesus would do this. And you try at the end, you try to make a spiritual point and everyone rolls their eyes and says, Debbie Downer, and then goes on to the next thing. Don't do that. But if you don't engage your group through media, you're missing out on one of the most prominent aspects of their lives. If you use media well, you can teach far beyond the small group gathering by getting people prepared for what they're going to hear on Sunday and reminding them what they heard on Sunday, by reminding them what they talked about, encouraging them to continue the thought process, giving them ways to interact with one another outside of the classroom. So some options that you might consider. First, you need to connect with them through some social media platform. Friend them on Facebook. You don't actually have to be friends with people to friend them on Facebook. Did you know that? It's one of these cool things, right? But it's funny how we use the language. People go, oh, I have 500 friends. No, you don't. You have 500 connections on Facebook. But that can be useful. So connect with your class members through social media so that you'll actually show up on their news feed. Realize that videos and photos are the most effective posts on Facebook. When you look at what gets viewed, if it's just text, people go right by it because they're scrolling down their news feed and there's so much stuff on there, they can't look at everything. They usually will stop on videos and photos. So if you want to make a point, do something weird and video yourself with your phone and post it, right? Or you can use, there are things online, there's a free service called Canva that I use. It's an okay website, but what it does is you can design cool graphics, like cooler things than you can do in PowerPoint, and it'll make them specifically the size for a Facebook post or a Facebook banner or a Twitter post or something like that. And you can use the cool text that everybody likes these days and the cool graphics. And there's a lot of free stuff on there. But if you make it look good, then people will just pause for the general 2 to 3 seconds they will give any post on Facebook. But if they read yours, then that's something. You've started something there, and they may pause on it. Why be completely ineffective by just posting text? The reality is, in general, people just scroll right by it. So if you're going to do this, at least do it semi-effectively. Be pithy. Be short. Be like Solomon, right? 2 lines. Convey a whole lot of wisdom in about 12 words. Or 140 characters, if you wish. Be pithy. Say as much as you can in as few words as possible. Generally speaking, if people have to click the keep reading button on Facebook, they won't. They'll go right by it. And you'll get about 140 characters in, and then that little button that says keep reading shows up, and they will not know what else you had to say. Choose your words wisely. Don't use social media as a second lesson. Use it as a reminder, right? Or use it as something to prepare. Ask a short question. Say, think about this. Be there Sunday to talk about it. You know, something really short. And incorporate media into your lesson. And again, I'm not just talking about TV. I mean, have somebody Google something in your lesson, right? Say, hey, I want to know, Google how many people are not affiliated with any religious organization? What percentage of the population is not affiliated? Have somebody Google it. They've got their smartphones. They'll do it. How weird is that? You're asking me to pull out my smartphone and Google something in the middle of the lesson? Yeah. Because I want to make a point, and I want to engage you in the lesson. And you're on your phone anyway. I might as well get you to use it for something good. Right? But again, this can be dangerous, because if you have people get on Facebook to look for something, they're not going to get off Facebook to listen to you anymore. Right? So be careful about this, but consider using it, because it will engage people in a way that's meaningful to them, in a way that's already part of their lives. So that's redeeming media. Now we've only got about 8 minutes left, so I want to do this fairly quickly. It is my opinion that if you do not have discussion as part of your lesson, then you are depriving people of the one way they have to apply the lesson to themselves. Discussion is vital to having people work through what you just said before they forget it. And so that's why I break my lessons down into about 10-minute teaching segments with discussion afterward. I do not want them to forget in 30 minutes what I said at the beginning of the lesson, so I want them to stop and I want them to think about it. I want them to digest that, write some things down, and then we'll go on to the next part of the lesson. But if you're going to do discussion, you've got to do it right. Application, this is my phrase, application perishes without discussion. If you don't have time for discussion, you're robbing them of the best opportunity they have to create life change. But if you don't control discussion, you may as well not have it. if you don't have a way that you are controlling the rabbits, that the rabbit trails people will go off in discussion, and they will do it, then you might as well not have it. This is how I do it. I train discussion leaders. I have a group of about 8 people in my class, one sitting at every table, and they have been trained on how to regulate discussion, how to stop conversations midstream if they're getting off, and to do it as politely as possible, and how to, if somebody gets emotional, how to deal with that. If somebody says, hey, I'm not a Christian, how do you deal with that? I mean, there are things that come up in discussion when you're asking people to talk around a table that you have to be prepared for. So what are some guidelines? First of all, ask good questions. This is part of that being prepared. This is why you can't make a lesson in 30 minutes, because you need to think about what are the questions that I can ask, not that will just get discussion going, but that will get fruitful discussion going. Not just generic questions, but questions that really get at the heart of what we're learning today. Ask open-ended questions. This is just good discussion 101. Don't ask yes or no questions unless you're going to follow it up with an application. How are you going to do this, right? Don't ask, do you do this? Do you think this? Ask how, ask what, ask why. All of those good open-ended questions to get discussion going. Become comfortable with silence. And this is what I train my table leaders on. If nobody talks, sit there and stare at them until they talk. Don't start talking for them, because they'll get used to that and then nobody actually discusses. You've just got a table leader who's teaching a mini lesson in the middle of the lesson. Teach them to be okay with the silence in order to draw people out of their shell and get them to say something. Be comfortable with interrupting. When I first started at First Dallas, there was a guy that when he started talking, he was not going to stop for 10 minutes. I learned that the first week when he didn't, and I didn't stop him. What I learned to do after that was he would talk and talk and talk, and then he would take a big breath to talk again, and I would jump in and I would say, thank you for that. If you want to keep going on that, I'd be glad to talk with you after a class. I would summarize what he said really quickly, and we would move on. Sometimes that's what you've got to do. You do it tactfully. Sometimes people will get annoyed with you. Sometimes they won't. I had one girl that, again, she would go, if she started talking, it was 5 to 10 minutes. I would interrupt her, and she would just keep talking. And I had to go out in the hall with her one day during a table discussion time, and I had to explain to her, this is why I'm interrupting you, and this is why we're going to have trouble if you don't stop doing this. Because the good of the many is more important than the good of the one in that case. I'm glad that you want to talk. This is not Amanda time, right? This is not Steve time. This is discussion time, and we want everyone to be involved. This is not time for you to pour your heart out and give everybody your life story. If you want to do that, I am certainly available after class for you to do that. And I will pray with you, and I will skip service to talk with you about this. But discussion time is for application. Never, ever let heresy go unaddressed. If somebody says salvation is by works, you stop everything and you correct that. Don't ever say, oh, I'm not sure about that, or okay, I see that point of view. Uh-uh. And you have to train leaders to be able to do this. You can do it yourself if you're leading the discussion, but if table leaders hear this, they have to be trained to say, no, wait a minute, that's not right. And they have to be willing to correct a person. Better that you correct a person there than lead a bunch of people astray by letting them think, oh, well, I guess that's okay. And if you discover somebody is not a Christian, you stop everything. I don't care what you're teaching. I don't care what you're discussing. If it's in the middle of table discussion and class needs to go on, you train that table leader to take that person aside and say, you know what, this is really important. If you don't mind, I really want to talk with you about what it means to be a Christian. They can step out in the hall. They can do whatever. But you do not let that person go out without at least sharing the gospel with them. Why else are we here, right? If non-Christians come into our midst and we don't share the gospel with them, that is something God will hold us accountable for. So train them to do that. And improve yourself. This is the fun part for me. I've created for my leaders a training program, and I actually have them role play so that I put new table discussion leaders in the most hostile environment they'll ever be in. This is where everybody at the table has a role, like the rabbit chaser, the emoter, the drug dealer, I call one of them the ghost, right? The person that never gets involved. And it is that person's job to lead about a 10-minute discussion to be able to target, to be able to tell me who was what role, and to be able to keep it all together. Why do I do that? Because they'll never encounter that in the real world. But whatever they do encounter, they'll be ready for it. Right, if you got one person trying to take you off on a rabbit trail while this person's crying and this person's sitting back acting like he doesn't want to be there, and you've got to rein that all in, then the next Sunday when the rabbit chaser goes off and nobody else is doing anything, it's easy to rein that back in. When the person gets really emotional and nothing else is going on, it's easy to rein that back in. So I created this training program. Train with other people in hostile environments. I mean, make it tough. It's fun. Say, you know, whatever happens here, it's not personal. We're just gonna train. So again, just like with teaching, solicit constructive criticism. Ask people, hey, how did you feel about our discussion today? Was there somebody that I didn't notice that wasn't involved? Did somebody go off? Did I let that person go on too long? Did somebody say something that was heresy that I didn't correct? Get that constructive criticism and have your leaders get that constructive criticism. And then go back to old lessons. I don't necessarily mean that you've recorded. I mean that you've typed up or written out. Reread your old questions that you asked people and ask yourself, is this good? Would this get good discussion going now? You'll find that you get better and better and better at it as you go along. I have about a decade's worth of lessons typed up in my computer, going all the way back to 2005 when I was a college student. I go back and I read those lessons, and they're not wrong, but I would never teach them anymore because they don't reach my standard anymore. I've gone beyond that. You should too. So keep track of what you've taught, and every once in a while, go 2 or 3 years back in your lessons and look at that stuff and say, you know, now that I'm better, what did I improve from that lesson? What could I learn from my own mistakes in the past? So that's some pointers to have good discussion, and that really incorporates all of what goes on in a life Bible study. You should teach people with the goal of facilitating life change. That means to get as many hooks into the idea that you're teaching as possible, get them to apply it, get them to talk about it, and get them to go beyond the classroom. Use the tools that you have to go beyond the classroom to remind them about it. It's not easy. Going back to James, don't sign up for this if God hasn't called you to this. You will be miserable or you will cause irreparable damage. But if God has called you to this, it's worth the effort. It's worth the work. And that's where we're going to stop. Do we have any questions? You got about 15 minutes before you have to be at your next lesson. So I'm willing to take questions, or if you want to skedaddle, you're free to do that.
Someone says something like, God would never give us more than we can handle.
Right.
Something like that. How do you handle that without shutting down discussion?
So let's just take that question in particular. God will never give us something more than you can handle. If you want to be polite about it, I would say, you know what? I've heard that before, but let me tell you about a time God gave me something that was bigger than I could handle to show me how he worked through me. The reality is that God does give us more than we can handle so that he can prop us up. And you do it in a respectful way, and you can do it rather quickly, just kind of redirect things. But if you don't agree with it, learn how to respond to that without being too blunt. Don't say, that's stupid, haven't you read the Bible? But say something like, you know what, I've heard that before, but you know, as I've come to read the Bible and to live the Christian life, here's what I've learned, that God actually does give us things we can't handle because he wants to work through us to accomplish them, and he wants to get the glory for it. And you know what? It is amazing when we get to go along on that journey with him. I feel like Gideon with 300 taking on 100,000 to see God work through my life and do things I never could have accomplished on my own. You see how the redirection is polite? It doesn't shame the person, but it instead says, you know, as I've matured as a Christian, I've actually come to understand that's not the whole truth. Something along those lines. You want to learn to be polite. Don't be rude. But at the same time, you've got to be firm, and you've got to move back to what the truth of the matter is. Does that make sense?
So when is discussion leader training?
I do it once a quarter, or I did. We have a different program going on at our church right now that kind of replaced what I did. I did it once a quarter. And you know what? People really enjoyed it. Like, they would get into their roles. If I can stump you, then I win, right? But it's fun, and it's a group-building exercise, and it really helps people, I think. So that's when I do it. I made all of mine up. I mean, I can send it to you, but I made it up. But there's tons of good books on that kind of stuff. If you just do an Amazon search or ask any of your ministers around here, they'll have suggestions. But I kind of created it for myself because I just like to do that. Anything else? All right, we're done. So y'all go on to your next classes. Thank you for being here.